WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. David Spiegel is a psychiatrist who works with people who have life-threatening illnesses. He says he's found that the best way to face the threat of serious illness is to look it right in the eye, to face the worst, rather than simply hoping for the best. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. He's conducted a landmark study on the value of support groups for women with metastasized breast cancer. Perhaps you saw the documentary on his work, which was featured on the Bill Moyers series, Healing in the Mind. Dr. Spiegel is the author of a book about facing life-threatening illness called Living Beyond Limits. It's just been published in paperback. Dr. Spiegel is critical of how both modern medicine and alternative medicine deal with illness.
I think the problem with modern medicine is what I like to think of as mindless materialism. The model in modern medicine is that the body is a machine like a car, and that if something goes wrong, you just replace the part. And we're so focused on high-tech intervention and on what I think of as the myth of cure. We really have, rather than a health care system, a disease cure system, in which the whole focus of medical intervention is thought to be curing illness, when the fact is that most Americans live with and die of chronic illnesses like heart disease, cancer, and stroke, and what people need from their doctors is caring, is learning how to live with these serious illnesses. So while certainly we should go for a cure whenever it's possible, I think we've lost sight of the oldest tradition of medicine, which is to cure rarely, to relieve suffering often, and to comfort always. And I think we've got it backwards, and we need to get back on the old track of what medicine is all about.
Now, you've said that you started your support group study expecting to prove that there wasn't a connection between survival and positive thinking. Why did you expect that you would find no connection, especially as a psychiatrist? Why did you expect that that connection wouldn't exist?
Well, being a psychiatrist teaches you modesty, and you learn that there are tough problems that you come up against. And I, knowing what I know about cancer and its progression, I thought that we could help people live better with it, that we could help reduce their anxiety and depression, and even help them control pain. But I was not prepared for the evidence that we found that enhancing social support and coping with disease might have an effect on the rate of progression. I'm interested in the problem, but the effect we found was just far stronger than anything I would have guessed at the beginning.
Share with us what the results were.
Well, we had 86 women who were assigned by what we call a randomization, in which you allow the toss of a coin or a computer to select who gets a year of weekly support group interventions and who gets just routine, standard, excellent medical oncology care. And we found after the initial year that the women who got the intervention, that was 50 of the 86, were less anxious and depressed and had half the pain. But what was much more surprising was that by the end of 4 years, all of the control group had died and a third of the treatment sample were still alive. And the average survival time for the intervention sample was 18 months longer than that in the control group.
Can you interpret the results? Why do you think it is so that women with breast cancer who were in a support group lived longer than their counterparts who didn't have that support group?
Well, there, you know, it seems almost mystical, but there are a number of studies that show that social integration is a powerful variable in mortality. This was reviewed in Science several years ago by James House. And in general, the relative risk of dying if you're socially isolated is elevated as much as if you had high serum cholesterol or smoked. It's a powerful relationship, and yet we ignore it, pay little attention to it. I think there are four possible mechanisms that could account for what we observed with breast cancer patients. The first is what I like to think of as the grandmother effect. Perhaps people who are less anxious and depressed and are coping with their disease better do all the things your grandmother told you to do. Eat well, sleep well, and get plenty of exercise. So it may be sort of the body maintenance things that these people do better. The second possibility is that they make better use of their health care, that they get diagnostic tests when they need them, that they adhere better to treatment regimens and get more vigorous treatment. They may elicit more vigorous treatment. You know, the doctor sees a woman who has lots to live for, has a book she wants to write or a project she wants to do, and figures, okay, we'll go that extra mile and give the next round of chemotherapy. So That's a second possibility. The third involves the endocrine system. Stress causes our body to release hormones like cortisol and prolactin in higher amounts. And these hormones have been shown to stimulate the growth of tumor cells, particularly breast cancer. That's why we often use estrogen receptor blockers like tamoxifen and Megase to slow the progression of cancer. So it is possible that if you handle stress better and if social support acts like a stress buffer, you may be reducing your own body's tendency to stimulate the growth of the tumor that's in it. And the fourth possible mechanism involves the immune system. We now know that the nervous system and the immune system talk to each other, that white blood cells that attack cancer cells respond to neurotransmitters, the chemicals that one nerve secretes to stimulate another nerve to action. We also know that cytokines, which are secreted by the white blood cells involved in the immune system, affect the central nervous system, and that stress can reduce the functioning of certain parts of the immune system, can increase vulnerabilities to infection, and that social support can buffer that block. So it's possible that in some way being a part of the group helped these women's immune systems function better.
I want to make it clear that you're not saying that positive thinking alone is going to help you a lot. You say denial and overly optimistic attitudes are not helpful.
Terry, that's absolutely right. I'm a proponent of realistic thinking, not positive thinking. In fact, the women in our group call that alternative point of view the prison of positive thinking. And an example is some woman started to cry and her husband said, "Stop crying, you'll make the cancer spread." Who needs that? What we try to do is help people realistically face what's ahead of them. And that means face the disease and its treatment, the fact that it may well shorten their lives, and live as well as you can in the face of that knowledge. So that means at times you won't be positive at all. You'll be sad, you'll be upset, you'll be frightened. But the interesting thing that I've seen time and again over the 15 years we've run these groups is that shortly after we're there crying about how terrifying this illness is and what it means, we'll be laughing about something else. And what you do is you free people to feel negative feelings and to feel positive feelings, to see the joy as well as the tragedy in life.
How does the support group experience compare to the typical conversations the women in the support group were able to have with their own families?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on how open the families are. But what we found is that there is a kind of intensity about the support groups that many women say is quite different from what they can usually do with their families. They know it's a place where they're going to deal with their worst fears, and it becomes a time and a place to, as one woman put it, feel better about feeling bad. They're with other people who know what they're going through. And so at times it's easier for them to share their fear, their sadness, their frustration, their anger with other women who are in the same boat than it is with family who have their own problems to deal with it as well.
Dr. David Spiegel is my guest, and his new book, Living Beyond Limits, is about facing life-threatening illness and the advantages of having a support group when you're facing it. I saw the Bill Moyers program about your support group, and one of the moments that I found really, really moving was when the daughter of one of the women in the group came and spoke with you, and mm-hmm. she was weeping, the daughter, and she said that, you know, her mother was the person who had the most faith in her. She'd had a lot of failures, but her mother always believed that she'd do fine, and she felt that when she lost her mother, she'd be losing her greatest friend and her greatest ally.
Yeah.
But she didn't feel like she could talk like this to her mother because she thought that her mother would fall to pieces if she heard this, and that they just both weep uncontrollably, and it would be miserable. What advice did you give her?
Well, no, I've never lost anybody in terminal weeping, and I advised her very strongly to have that talk with her mother. Now, and this was an unusual situation, and that fortunately her mother watched the Bill Moyers show, too, so she got,
right.
got the message. But one of the touching things in that meeting, actually, the best advice came from the mother of a woman who was dying, and she said to her daughter, "You're my best friend." They both started to cry, and the daughter said, I knew that, but it means so much more that you've told me that. And I think there are a lot of things that we take for granted that, of course, they know that, and we don't bother telling people, and they're the most important things in life. And the proximity of death, if it's handled right, can get you to say those things that you want to be sure the person knows before they die.
You make the point in your book that hope for a cure is just one kind of hope. What are the other kinds of hope that you think, for instance, a support group can offer?
Support groups can offer hope that if you can't be cured, that you can live a very interesting, productive, worthwhile life during the time that you're coping with the progression of the illness. So it's a kind of realistic hope. It's not the false hope that life will be the way it was before this all happened, which is what everybody understandably wants, but many cannot have. But it's a different kind of hope. They can watch somebody who, we had one woman in the group who'd been a frustrated poet all of her life, and before she died, she had written two small, very fine books of poetry. I quote some of her poems in Living Beyond Limits. And so they can see that life isn't over, that it may not go on, you may not die when you're 95 in your sleep, but there's a lot of interesting, worthwhile things that you can do, and you know it's true because you see other people in the same boat as yours who are doing it. So I think it provides a kind of realistic hope in which people kind of redefine the horizons of their life, what the dimensions of it are, but then say, okay, given that, what can I do that I want to do with my life now?
Do you talk about this a lot with the people in the group, the responsibility of the dying to the living?
You bet. That's a major issue. And some lovely things have come of it. I just attended a memorial service for a woman who died several weeks ago. And she sat down and wrote a letter to her four-year-old that was read at the service in which she talked about how she had been reluctant to play the piano because she didn't do it perfectly, and she set very high standards to herself. But one day she did, and she turned around and noticed that her four-year-old was dancing to the music. And she said, "You gave me a gift because I realized I was playing just fine if you could enjoy it that much." And that's a legacy for her daughter. And this is something where she was giving a gift to her daughter that is of tremendous importance.
I don't know exactly what my question is here, but it has to do with acceptance versus anger. When something happens to you very sudden, you know, like suddenly finding out about an illness, your life has changed, and suddenly there's this big line, this big before and after line, mm-hmm. and nothing after will ever be quite the same.
That's right.
And so you could get really angry about it, or you could try to work yourself into this state of acceptance about it, hoping that eventually you will accept it. And, you know, I sometimes can't tell which is better. I mean, it seems like anger is really justified, although maybe pointless. And you don't, you know, maybe acceptance too soon is either kidding yourself or giving in when maybe it's better to fight.
Well, I think you're right, Terry. You know, in a sense, you don't control your feelings. You control what you do about them. You control what you think and how you cope. But your feelings happen to you. And I think there's something sometimes phony or unduly constraining about saying, well, you know, I'm supposed to be past this stage now, so I won't be angry. I'll
right,
be
there's
this.
The four stages of how one copes, blah,
right,
blah.
Right,
yeah.
And people aren't like that. And mm-hmm. so what I'm saying is just give yourself room to feel what you feel.
Right.
Now, just because you're angry doesn't mean you go out and do all kinds of crazy things about it. But if you feel that way, feel it. That's okay. And what I find is that people shift from state to state. So for a while, they'll be mad as hell, and then they'll somehow find that they're just not as angry about it as they used to be. But then maybe 2 months later, they will be again, and that's okay. It's a matter of giving yourself permission to feel whatever it is you feel about it.
You write that serious illness is not a good thing, but good things can come out of it. I hate hearing that kind of statement from somebody who's a real Pollyanna, but you're not. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you mean when you say good things can come of it.
Well, it can. What I mean is, I don't think anybody wishes it on themselves. I think it's a terrible mistake to tell people that they needed their illness and that's why they got it. That's nonsense. But what I am saying is this, that if the illness becomes an occasion for you to take stock of your life and get rid of some things that have been, in retrospect, mistakes, and commit yourself to new things, to tell people you care about how much you care about them, to do things you've been putting off but need doing, it doesn't mean that the illness is good, but it means you can make something good of it. If you can use your experience of coping with cancer to help somebody else get through it better, that is a genuinely good thing that you're doing for someone else that came out of something that's a tragedy. But you know what? A lot of human life is like that. You know, we have to live with tragedy. It's a part of life. And the best things we do in the human condition are making something decent out of those tragedies.
Dr. David Spiegel is a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine. His book, Living Beyond Limits, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. This is Fresh Air.